Hello and welcome to another episode of Insights from Sight Loss Friendly Church. I am Lynn Davis and with me is Matthew Horsfall. And today we are asking the question, people with sight loss can't use computers, can they?
Well, isn't it funny? You and I are both totally blind and we're both sat at our individual computers recording this podcast. And we work for Torch and we, as part of that job, go on Zoom and we read emails and look up contact information on our CRM system and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. So we're on computers all the time. And then I don't know about you, but I also use computers in my personal life to prepare things for church, amongst other things. So I think it's definitely true to say that people with sight loss should be able to use computers.
Yes. I use computers in my personal life as well, because also there's so much fun you can have with computers. I like to write fiction, I like to be creative, write music, write songs. So for me, computers is like, if I don't have a computer, which I didn't for a couple of months at the start of the pandemic, I didn't have a computer and I really hated it because I couldn't unfold myself in a creative manner, let alone work. Well, I didn't have a job then because it was when all the stuff was happening with lockdown and all that stuff. But life without a computer for me is a life not really worth living. That's how much computers are integrated into my daily life.
Yeah, because they unlock access to so much, don't they? I mean, we're talking about computers, but I mean, computers in the broadest sense, you know, desktop and laptop computers, obviously, but also smartphones, tablets, all of that sort of thing. And I mean, certainly life without a computer would be difficult. Life without a smartphone, virtually impossible, because I can use the Maps apps on smartphones to help me with bus travel. I can use the camera on the iPhone to read my post. You know, there's all of this sort of stuff that we just rely on computer-based technology for. It really has been an enormous game changer.
Oh, totally. I don't know what I would do without my smartphone. I also use it to play audiobooks. I use it to watch Netflix when someone else is using the TV. I use it to watch YouTube, go on social media, chat with my friends and family on WhatsApp, and of course it's all the other stuff that you mentioned, reading your mail and maps and finding recipes and stuff, you know. So I think when I was referring to computers, I'm still of the generation that thinks of computer as a desktop or a laptop. I think that says something about my age, which we're not going to get into. It's not that old, but you know, we'd like to leave people guessing, right?
Yeah. I'm also of that generation, actually. It's just it when you start to think about it in broader terms, you start to realize that actually there's a lot of computers around nowadays.
There really is, because a smartphone is a little computer.
Mm.
But as to the question that we asked in the beginning, I think the short answer is yes, and we could finish the episode there. But as with everything, there are gray zones and not everything is black and white.
Yeah, so I think probably we should actually talk about how we use computers, and then that will probably explain why it is that some people may struggle to use computers, because it is definitely fair to say that not every blind person feels comfortable using a computer, even though theoretically the technology is out there to use them. So the main way in which I access, and I think the way you access, Lynn, computers, smartphones, tablets, etc., is via a piece of software called a screen reader, which basically is, as the name suggests, it sits on top of a normal computer. So we're not using a specially adapted computer. It's a normal Windows computer or a normal Apple iPhone or whatever it happens to be, but with a special piece of software on it. And no, it's not called Siri. A lot of people think, yeah, we use Siri and that helps the blind people to use their phone. We do use Siri, but there's a more detailed piece of software, if you like, called VoiceOver. On Windows, there's a free built-in screen reader called Narrator. There's a free, much better program called NVDA, and there's a paid-for program called Jaws. And of course, I use Jaws. But, you know, they sit on the computer and they speak out whatever is on the screen, but they do so in such a way that it makes sense, and we can be quite granular about it. So we can read the whole screen, or when we're moving up and down a list of emails, it will just tell us the email that we've landed on, the subject and who it's from. Or we can drill down even further and we can read the word under the cursor, the letter under the cursor. You know, if you're in a document, you can read the line, the sentence, the paragraph. You can move to different portions of the screen, like the menus, and it will then just read, you know, if you're across the top file edit view, you know, or in the modern ribbons, it will just tell you the bit that you're on. It won't tell you the rest of the screen because you don't need to know the rest of the screen. So it's very detailed. And consequently, there are quite a lot of keystrokes to remember and quite a lot of vocabulary to remember before you can really sort of get up and running with them.
Yes. And I use JAWS because I learned how to do that from I was very young. It was what I used to do my schoolwork. And for me, that vocabulary, those keystrokes, it sort of becomes a second language. So for me, if somebody says you need to press the radio button on that page and then you need to tick the checkbox and all that, for me, that makes perfect sense. But it might not make perfect sense for somebody who hasn't used it before. And they will say, well, a radio button, what is that? I mean, it does sound like a big, huge round button on a radio. So I can imagine that that can be confusing and that lingo can be confusing. The reason that I use JAWS, and I suspect you do as well, Matthew, is because as the screen reader, that is the expensive one that costs a lot of money. It is far more developed than any of the free and open source software that is out there, which is perfectly fine to use, but it has more basic functionality than JAWS, which can actually do everything that you said and then some. The way I explain JAWS to my friends or to somebody who doesn't understand screen readers is I say that everything you see on the screen, I hear on the screen. And that's the easiest way to do it. But of course, there are things even JAWS can't do. So things like graphics, there might be pictures that you need to click on. Sometimes if you're going to fill out a form, you can't actually type in the field, or you can't tick the boxes because the way it's been set up with pictures, if it's a PDF form, you need to print it and then you can't fill it anyway. So it can't do everything, but it can do far more than every other screen reader out there.
Well, and it's not even so much that it can do far more, it's the intuitiveness with which it can do it. So I think every screen reader now can tell you if you ask it. It doesn't tell you by default. But for example, if something's bolded or centered or in a different color, if you request that information from the screen reader, if you press the button that says what font is this or what justification is, it will tell you. And you can make it, I mean, you can make all the screen readers now tell you that information as it comes across it, but it's quite lengthy. You know, if you're reading a document and it's every 5 minutes saying bold, not bold, bold, not bold, red, white, blue, you know, it's very frustrating. So the beauty of JAWS is that you can set it up to do different things when that comes in. So you can make it slow down if it's in bold, or you can make it use a different voice if it's in a different color, or if there's a spelling error, you can make it play a sound. And so it's not so much the access to the information, but the efficiency and the intuitiveness with which you can get access to that information.
That is right. I tried using VoiceOver on the Mac once, because the iPhone, like JAWS, is quite intuitive as well. It's very easy to use. For people who are not familiar with VoiceOver, it's something that every Apple product has that can be switched on, which makes the product fully accessible to someone who's blind. And I was told as well in the Apple store, and of course they would tell you that the Mac is really intuitive, just like the iPhone, and I will love it. But I found it really difficult, because whereas with JAWS, I can press E to get to the edit field on a page. So if I'm filling out a form and I know I need to fill out my name, I press an E and then it will say first name. And I then know to press the enter and type my name. If I do that on a Mac, I have to press three or four keys to get to the same thing, and it is uncomfortable and it interrupts the workflow. Mac can be good for things like music, for example, music production, where you don't have to write anything. But I find that anywhere where you have to navigate and write and do lots of different things, the VoiceOver just doesn't quite cut it on a Mac, and it really made me appreciate Jaws in a whole different way. Because it's a screen reader I'm used to, I always thought about it as, you know, I'm sure there might not be anything better, or you start taking it for granted. But when I experienced the Mac, I had definitely a newfound appreciation for Jaws, and yeah, I'm staying.
Yeah, I agree with you. So before this turns into a massive sponsorship opportunity for Jaws, let's turn our attention to how to learn how to use this stuff. So you were talking about how you learned to use Jaws in school. I also learned how to use Jaws in school, and I think we were both very lucky, because as an adult trying to learn this stuff, you know, if you've lost your sight later on in life and you've got to learn all of this vocabulary, like I say, radio buttons, combo boxes, check boxes, list views, and what's the difference between a list view and a list box? And, you know, you have to know all this stuff before you can really harness the power of the computer. And when do I press tab? And when do I press up and down arrow? And when do I press F6? And when do I press escape versus when do I press Alt F4? And there's actually quite a lot to learn. Where, as a blind adult, as a person who's losing their sight for the first time, is maybe a bit older, you know, where does that training come from?
Well, I think you may know this better than me, actually, because you do some training like that as well. But a lot of this training can come from things like resource centres. So it could be that the RNIB will organise courses for people who have lost their sight. It could be as well that you can get it through Access to Work, which allows you to kind of access computers and other equipment through work. Or as a student, you can learn it as a student. There are different avenues into learning it. And just because you didn't know it from when you were a child, just like a language, you can learn Spanish and speak fluent Spanish as an adult. You can also learn to speak fluent Jaws, if that makes sense.
Mm, you can. So I think the takeaway for me from that is that training can be quite expensive. So if you're a student, then you can get training through Disabled Students Allowance. If you're in work, you can get training through Access to Work. And the quality of that training is usually quite high. It's not always funded well enough. So I've been in environments where someone said, right, yeah, you've got half a day's training. And in that half a day's training, you need to learn how to use Jaws with Microsoft Outlook. Well, yeah, but if you've never used Jaws before and you've never used Outlook as a blind person before, half a day's training isn't really going to cut it. You're going to need probably about 6 months of training, you know, once a week for an hour or two, to really get to grips with what it is you've got to do and to learn it well enough to be able to use it intuitively in your job. So that can be a problem. But of course, if you tell Access to Work that, then hopefully they will fund you some more training. The problem is, as I say, training is quite expensive. The good trainers get quite a lot of money out of doing this sort of training. And so you end up then in situations where training is offered at resource centres by volunteers who are not necessarily as skilled as the professional trainers that are going out and doing it for Access to Work, possibly have quite low expectations themselves of what blind and partially sighted people can do, and really just don't understand how the screen readers operate. So some resource centres are better than others. Some will do a really good job. Some will do a terrible job. And the sad reality is, if you live in an area where the resource centres aren't very good and you're not in a job, whether that's because you're not in a job because you can't find one, or you're not in a job because you've retired, the training is just not there. And so you may very well, in a church context, come across a person with sight loss who theoretically could use a computer but just cannot find the training in order to make that work.
I was just also thinking that, of course, today we have the luxury of social media as well, and there are ways of connecting up with people in that way, even to just get advice on getting training. So that there are blindness groups out there. If you look on Facebook, for example, there are groups like VI Talk. There are other more techie groups as well. And the group so much doesn't really matter, and the subject matter of the group, as long as it is a visually impaired group, there's always a person in my experience, and there are always multiple people in my experience, who are screen reader trainers themselves and who might be able to offer training or who might be able to actually guide you towards training. So that's another thing to do at church. You know, if you're a social media savvy pastor or church leader or church volunteer, then, you know, find blindness groups out there that might be able to at least put you in the direction of where to go if you need sort of the basic training, because asking around can really be helpful in getting to know stuff that you might otherwise not be able to find out by making 50 phone calls to the RNIB and alike.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. The only thing I would say on that topic, which slightly doesn't necessarily differ but adds a bit of nuance to it, if you're going to do that, and it's a wonderful thing that you can do as a member of the congregation or as a member of a church leadership to help a person with sight loss out, if you're going to do it, try not to do it on your own, because potentially it could be a very long journey. Once you've started to offer that person help, you could be offering that person help for, as I say, 6 months, 9 months, you know, 2 years, you know, until they're really on their feet and don't need your help anymore. And some people may never get to a point where they don't need your help anymore. So that's not to say don't do it, but talk to other people in the church about what you're doing. And maybe quite early on, if you can manage it, set a precedent of you do some of the work and somebody else in the church does some of the other work and somebody else in the church does some of the other work, so that the person with sight loss doesn't see you as the only person who can help them.
Yeah, and the ideal situation here would be, for example, if you went on Facebook, you found somebody who recommended you a resource centre that could help. So that could be a local one that you didn't know about, or it could be a national one that is really good. The best thing is, of course, get in touch with that resource centre and let they take over the job. So as quickly as you can, leave it to the professionals who do this kind of training, just because you don't want to have a too big workload, just like you mentioned. And there are several reasons why that is a good idea to go that way. But if you can just delegate that to different people in the congregation, that's a better way to go about it if there are no professional body available that can pick it up immediately.
Yeah. Speaking of professional bodies, there are other things that the person with sight loss is going to need training in besides assistive technology at this point. So we're talking about computers, but they're also going to need training using the white cane, being in the kitchen, you know, all of that sort of thing. And adult social services, adult social care, sensory impairment team, whatever it's called in your local area, the council will be able to help with some of that. And they probably won't be able to help with computer training, but because they're helping with the other aspects of coming to terms with sight loss, they may know people who can help out with computer training, who may not necessarily be the resource centre, but, you know, the council knows them, the council can recommend them. They, you know, so the council is another good set of people to talk to in this situation.
So there you go. Now you know that people with sight loss can definitely use computers and smartphones and the technology that we see around us, but it's just getting them to have the right training if they haven't had it previously and how to go about that. So hopefully that has given you a few ideas. And that's all we got time for. If you have anything you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, please get in touch with us. You can email us on slfc@torchtrust.org. SLFC stands for Sight Loss Friendly Church. You can pick up the phone and call us on 01 858 438 260 or alternatively, visit our website www.torchtrust.org. From me, Lynn Davis and Matthew Horsepaugh, thanks for listening and see you next time.